Senate Republicans unveiled a revised version of their health care bill today. The bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, could come to a vote as soon as next week.
The revised bill is one that is likely to please conservatives, but moderates and Democrats are still likely to take issue with it. Cuts to Medicaid would begin in about 8 years, and according to the Congressional Budget Office, those changes will result in 15 million fewer people enrolled in the program.
Joining us now for a look at the impact of these changes and more is Donna Friedsam. She's a researcher and health policy director at UW-Madison's Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Well, it's like a biweekly or monthly conversation we're having about the latest health care bill. But looking at this one, before we dig into the details, big picture, how different is this bill from the last time we talked to you?
Well, it retains the large body of provisions that were in the previous Senate health bill, including the name of the previous bill, but it does have some significant changes, four principal changes that I'm happy to go through with you.
Now let's talk about some of the changes, and a big one people have been talking about is coming from mainly Senator Ted Cruz, apparently allowing companies that have health care plans on the exchange meeting the conditions of the exchange to have stripped down cheaper plans that don't meet all those conditions. Can you talk about that?
Right. So it would allow companies to, if they provide at least one plan on the exchange that meets the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare requirements, it could also offer plans that are not compliant with the requirements of Obamacare. So it would be, those plans would be exempt from community rating and guaranteed availability and requirements that bar insurers from denying coverage for pre-existing conditions or varying premiums based on health status and the like. And it also would require, or insurers would not have to offer a set of essential health benefits and certain protections against catastrophic costs.
Right. And as I understand it, the pro on that is young, healthy people would have a cheap alternative that would cover kind of the worst case stuff, but maybe not much else. But then a lot of people are pointing to it saying, in effect, you'd end up with a two-tiered system where coverage for people with pre-existing conditions or other health concerns, things could get more expensive for them. How do you break that down?
It seems that what it essentially is doing is turning the marketplace coverage of the Obamacare protections within the marketplace into a high-risk pool, and essentially separating, making two separate markets, one for people, the healthier, younger people who want to buy really minimal coverage at low prices, and another market within the Obamacare marketplace for people who perhaps need more comprehensive coverage and need to get, and if they qualify for subsidies, they could get that on the Obamacare marketplace, even though it will be very expensive.
What does that do to the market, ultimately, if we end up with that kind of two-part system?
So the big concern there is, let me just say first that it would have the effect, indeed, of providing opportunities for very reduced price coverage for healthier, younger people than perhaps they can get today, but it would also be coverage that covers a lot less than what they might imagine would be covered under the existing protections that the ACA offers. So that would be exposing them to things that costs that they might not have anticipated if something does happen to them. And as well, it would expose them to very high deductibles and cost sharing. That being said, the people that would need more comprehensive coverage, they would have to they would see themselves purchasing it through the Obamacare marketplaces that still have all those consumer protections, but that the price of that coverage will get very expensive because there's not, the risk is not being pooled with the younger, healthier people any longer. Now, because there are federal subsidies available for people at lower incomes below 350% of the federal poverty level, those people might be somewhat protected from some of those increasing costs. But some other changes in the Senate bill that existed even before today's amendments suggests that there's going to be a lot higher exposure even for those people within the Obamacare marketplace to higher prices with this change.
Talking to Donna Friedstrom from UW-Madison's Population Health Institute, looking at the latest version of the Senate health care plan that would replace parts of the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned four substantial changes from the previous Senate version, assuming that that Ted Cruz one we were just talking about was one of the big ones. What are the other key changes as you see them?
Well, there is a substantial provision to allow people to purchase coverage from within their health savings accounts. That's pre-tax money. And a number of analysts see that as a very substantial tax break, particularly for upper-income people who are more likely to be able to have the discretionary dollars to be able to contribute to an HSA. But on the other hand, HSAs are a purchasing vehicle for supporting health expenses and maybe something that provides more flexibility for people who want to have more choice in their in what kinds of coverage they purchase. There are some funds that have been added to the existing bill to support opioid prevention and treatment, about $45 billion in funding, and there has been about $70 billion in funding added for market stabilization that would go to insurance companies to help them handle the senators anticipate to be higher costs associated with the number of people that are going to be needing coverage that won't be able to afford the coverage through the existing subsidies.
And those stabilization funds, I mean, that's been an issue with the Affordable Care Act. Democrats have accused Republicans, once they got control of the Senate and House, of not providing those kind of funds that the Affordable Care Act was kind of based on. Is that right?
There's been a lot of debate about what kind of stabilization funds are required, and the House bill and the Senate bill, the first version of the Senate bill and now this Senate bill, have slowly increased the funding for market stabilization, but now it's starting to suggest that perhaps what is now being called market stabilization is what was previously under the Obamacare mechanism, the risk reinsurance and risk adjustment and risk corridors program is considered to be, from some senators' perspectives, a giveaway to the insurance industry, from other people's perspective, a way to make up for the losses that will be experienced because of insufficient funding for people to be able to support or purchase their coverage because of the subsidies are not well enough supported. So there's a great debate about why these kinds of stabilization funds are needed. And so we don't have much agreement yet about whether, number one, whether we should have them, and number two, whether if we need them, is this enough money for them?
And then people in the previous version, one of the big concerns was a couple of different changes to Medicaid, lowering funding levels compared to the current projections from what they'd be, say, over the next 10 years or so, and also whether that would be something done directly from the federal government versus block grants to the states. What does Medicaid look like in this new Senate proposal?
There have been no substantial changes to the Medicaid provisions. The Medicaid program is still slated to take about a very substantial cut, really about a 35% cut over a decade, and with states having the option of going to a block grant or a per capita cap, and a very significant reductions in the federal participation in the state in its share of state expenses. So that remains the same. There is a new provision, though, that in the amendments that were added today, that would allow outside of the per capita cap, the federal government might step in and add additional money in the event that the state were facing some kind of a public health emergency or an outbreak such as the Zika virus.
So that an acute health emergency wouldn't strain that per capita cap right off the bat then under that?
That is what is contemplated with this additional fund that's in there, yes.
Let's take a caller now. Ronnie is with us in Germantown. Ronnie, hi.
Hi, how are you? I just want to find out what's going on with Medicare, because all the talk is about Medicaid and other cuts. How is Medicare going to be affected? Answer offline.
Donna, Medicare.
Yeah. So, Ronnie, I know a lot of people have that concern, and let me just say a couple things about that. Under the previous Senate bill, there was a lot of attention paid to a tax cut that had existed that would have affected the sustainability of the Medicare Trust Fund, and that tax cut has actually been removed under today's amendments. So that is actually one thing that does improve. However, there is a concern for the Medicare population in that many people who have Medicare also rely on Medicaid for their long-term care and their long-term support services, so their activities of daily living or other kinds of supports they may need in the community. They actually get that through Medicaid. And many people don't realize that actually most of Medicaid funds are spent on the elderly and the disabled, who are as well Medicare eligible. So the changes that we see in Medicaid will substantially affect the Medicare population as well.
We're talking to Donna Friedsam. Thanks for that call, Ronnie. Donna's a researcher and health policy director at UW-Madison's Population Health Institute. We're looking at some of the changes in the latest version of the Republican Senate health care bill.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you support the continuing effort to replace Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act? Are you pleased with the revisions, like a stability fund to keep down premiums? And what about the changes to Medicaid? Are you concerned about how those changes will affect you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with Donna Friedsam, researcher and health policy director at UW-Madison's Population Health Institute. We're looking at the latest version of the Senate Republican health care bill and what kind of changes it could bring.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the latest effort to replace Obamacare? What do you think of the slimmed down benefit requirements for insurers? Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go right back to our callers. Rod is on the line in Madison. Rod, hi.
Hi. Yeah, see, the question that I had, well, actually there's two, but the main one was, I just got onto Medicare 3 months ago. I turned 65. How is what they're talking about doing now and with all these cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and those type of things, are those things going to start affecting everybody who's already in the system, or are these things that are going to be future things and it's not going to affect our current coverage for us and, of course, until we're gone?
Rod, thanks for the call. And Donna, from what you were saying earlier, it sounds like the Medicare part of it for Rod might not change. But if he's in a situation where he'd need Medicaid along with that, he might see some changes.
Absolutely. This will affect people, anybody. This is not something where people who are currently enrolled will get grandfathered in with their current coverage. It will affect people who, as the provisions take effect, everybody who's in the program will be under the provisions as they take effect. And with regard to Medicare, anybody who's in Medicare will be affected by the long-term sustainability of the Medicare program. This bill that we have before us this week doesn't directly speak to the Medicare program, except to the degree that Medicare and Medicaid are very closely tied, particularly, as I note, because many Medicare members also rely on Medicaid for long-term support services.
Rod, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Peter in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I'm really disappointed with the bill that's been introduced. One aspect of it that I think is actually quite disappointing is that when Trump was running for president, he said he was going to use the purchasing power of the federal government to negotiate better prescription drug prices through Medicare. And there's absolutely nothing in this bill that does anything about prescription drug prices at all. So I feel like that's one aspect of this that Trump ran on that he now is his campaign promise didn't come through on.
Peter, thanks for the call. Donna, do we see much of anything on prescription drug pricing in any incarnation of the House or Senate healthcare bills?
Not what's being addressed currently, no.
And there have been legislative efforts, I know, to at least introduce bills on prescription drug pricing, targeting those big price increases on special kinds of medications. Is there a lot of action outside of this healthcare bill?
There has been discussion, but the kind of action that I think the caller was referring to is not occurring.
Peter, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mary Kay with us in Milwaukee. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi there. I have a question for your guest. Given the policy, the way it's going to be going out as of right now, it seems as though, from what she said, people would have an opportunity under some conditions to choose to have a stripped-down plan, kind of a bare-bones plan. And they may or not get decent coverage because the insurer would have the right to make a decision about what they would offer. My question is, if people buy those plans, and many people had those before the Obamacare was passed. My daughter had one of them. And what happens if they get very ill and require care for something that's not included in one of those plans? Doesn't that mean that those people who are being forced to purchase more expensive plans because of existing conditions, et cetera, the poor, some of the working poor, and that, aren't they going to be bearing the burden of this? Because somebody has to pay for that.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Donna, how do you see that playing out?
I think those points are very observant. That ultimately, if people purchase those slimmed down plans that don't have the full coverage, if something happens to them that is not within the scope of coverage, they will not be able to get have that paid for. And as well, they may have their coverage rescinded even. So, and the coverage under the slimmed down plans would not count as creditable coverage for not for pre-existing condition continuous coverage, and that's a very complex thing way of saying that they would have to wait 6 months before they could get coverage, more comprehensive coverage for a pre-existing condition. Even after that, they essentially would have to get their treatment in some kind of uncompensated care manner, and the cost of that treatment would fall on the healthcare system. And as your caller notes, ultimately those costs get absorbed across the board by mostly by people with some kind of employer-sponsored coverage and the like.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. We're talking to Donna Friedsum from the UW-Madison Population Health Institute, looking at the latest incarnation of the Senate Republican health care plan. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you. A question that I have regarding all the health care plans is, one, why not just increase the mandate so that people who basically are avoiding the health care costs are taxed appropriately with the other people who are obtaining health insurance? And second, how much of this is also, you hear so many different sides and so many plans, how much of this is politics as opposed to pure people saying, how do we solve this so that we get a good plan and a good way going forward?
Charlie, thanks for the call. So part one there, boost the mandate penalties, basically, Charlie's saying, I think, but the Republican plan's going away from the mandate in the first place, right, Donna?
Yeah, the mandate was a very controversial and unpopular part of the Affordable Care Act, but people really do like being able to have the protection of getting coverage regardless of pre-existing condition. So the difficult policy piece of all this, and that's making it difficult to come to a solution, is how do you get healthy young people to participate in the market without a mandate while you require insurance companies to accept all people without pre-existing conditions? And whether this is politics, there certainly are some politics involved, but really this is a very difficult policy solution to come up with in a country where we have different values, a very broad base of perspectives around what is the role for government and how much tolerance people have for government mandates.
Thanks, Charlie. Terry is with us next in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Donna, for all your expertise, but this question, no question for you, really, but I'm just getting upset about the conversation. We talk about risk corridors and tax subsidies and deductibles and premiums and health savings accounts and high risk and individual mandate. I just want to be able to walk into a hospital, not have a bill, have comprehensive coverage, and just walk out. That's what I want. And I think that's what anybody wants. And we need to get above the fray of all this nitty-gritty, because we're going to be tackling the healthcare situation another 2 years from now when Democrats start taking over the House and stuff like that.
Terry, thanks for the call. Is there a way to cut through the Gordian knot here, Donna, and have a real simple solution like Terry's talking about?
Well, what I would suggest, and I would go back to my previous comment, is that we are a big country with a lot of different perspectives, and certainly this is one of those perspectives. And other people would say, you know, no, that's not a solution, that that people would not utilize their care with judiciously, and that people need to have incentives about how to use care when they need it and when they don't need it. And there's all kinds of debate about this and that. So, you know, we have to remember that we have 1/6 of our economy tied up in this, and there's a lot of different financial interests concerning who's using care and who's making their salary on care. And so that's why it's very difficult for us to get here to there. But what I would
I have to jump in, Donna, because we are out of time. Thanks so much to Donna Friedsam from the UW-Madison Population Health Institute.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lawsuit challenges President Trump for blocking followers on Twitter. We'll look at the uncharted First Amendment landscape of politics.
And on Food Friday, we'll get recipes and guidelines for making delicious and nutritious smoothies and juices.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.